When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy, and this week we're asking, can Colombia stay on the path to peace? My guest at the Global Education and Skills Forum in Dubai was Juan Manuel Santos, President of Colombia from 2010 to 2018. He achieved what many had thought impossible, ending 52 years of war with FARC guerrillas. He inaugurated a truth commission to investigate crimes against civilians and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2016. Now he's a member of the Global Commission on Drug Policy and teaches at Harvard and Oxford universities. But Colombia remains deeply divided, and in recent weeks, his hard-won peace has looked especially fragile. Some say Mr. Santos brought an imperfect peace, failing to bring justice and ignoring the security threats of other dissident groups. The new president, Iván Duque, is challenging part of the agreement for being too lenient to the FARC. And in January, after an explosion blamed on the National Liberation Army, or ELN, killed 21 people in Bogotá, thousands took to the streets to march for an end to violence. I asked Juan Manuel Santos how he assesses his legacy now.
There's no such thing as a perfect peace agreement. It's a negotiation, and all peace agreements have imperfections. And this peace agreement was the most comprehensive, most profound peace agreement that has ever been negotiated. I think it's irreversible. We have some way to go in order to implement what was agreed. Because we were very ambitious, and of course many people think that we have not advanced fast enough, and other people, as always happens, it happened in Northern Ireland, it happened in South Africa, it happened in Salvador. Every peace agreement where you draw the line between peace and justice, you have people from one side and from the other who are not happy.
So what's the balance of that? Now, we're going to dive a little bit into what's happened subsequently. But if you're being frank with yourself and with us, peace and justice, how much has had to be traded away?
Well, we think we drew the line in the ideal point of finding enough justice to allow peace, which was the objective since the beginning. And I think this is happening. We already have a special tribunal. We are the only country that has negotiated peace under the umbrella of the Rome Statute, the only country who has put the victims in the center of the solution and their rights to justice, to reparations, to the truth, and that is working. So peace in Colombia with the FARC is irreversible, and we're struggling to construct the peace, which is many times more difficult than simply achieving or signing an agreement to end the war.
But let's look at an angle of that which helped drive the conflict and had absolutely terrible consequences in Colombia and beyond, and that's the cocaine trade. And yet, according to the UN report at the end of 2018, Colombia was producing more cocaine than ever in its history. Why so? And why was it so difficult to make the end of that conflict, or at least the retreat of the conflict in its most serious form, go along in tandem with reducing the drug trade and dealing with it?
The peace agreement is giving us, for the first time, a solution, a structural long-term solution to the problem of planting coca. And why do I say this? Because for the first time, we are going to be able to, and we're doing that, to give the coca peasants an alternative. If we had no way to give them an alternative, they would keep on planting coca. Right now, we put in place, thanks to the peace agreement, a program whereby we are giving them an alternative. We're subsidizing their transition, and that is working. We have to allow for the program to work, but this is the only way we can reduce permanently the production of coca, because we've been trying to do it for the last 40 years, and we have failed. This is a battle or a war, and I think I share this with the economists that the world declared more than 40 years ago, and that has not been won. So it has been lost. So we need to have new ways, new approaches, different from the traditional way of fighting drug trafficking, because the way we have been fighting has been a failure.
Let's stay on that for a second. What would you do in concrete terms now differently? And you can perhaps look at solutions that are more difficult than they are when you're in office.
When I was in office, I was the one who proposed to the world a new approach to the problem of drugs. And that ended in the special session of the United Nations in the year 2016 to address this problem, where unfortunately we did not make as much progress as we wanted. But now at least many countries in the world are approaching the drug trafficking and the problem of drugs as a public health problem instead of simply a police problem. And we are seeing countries that are legalizing the marijuana trade, which I think is the right way to go.
You passed the deal with FARC at great personal political cost, having had a honeymoon period, really, which went on for quite a long time, of great popularity and very good economic performance in Colombia. You left office as one of the most unpopular Colombian presidents. It's a bit of a paradox, isn't it?
Yes, because I have always thought, and that has been my way of approaching government, you do what is correct, not what is popular. Making peace is always more difficult than making war. And when I was elected the first time, I was elected with the highest margin ever in the Colombian politics and the Colombian elections, because I was very successful making war. To switch to a peacemaker, and they warned me, was going to be very difficult, and I was going to become very unpopular, as has happened to many peacemakers. But history will decide, and it's deciding now, because my ratings have gone up in the last year tremendously without me having to speak one single word. So I think the people will realize that the correct decision was to make peace.
Thousands of Colombians have been marching in Bogota, holding vigils for peace. They do seem to fear that your deal is under threat, even if your personal legacy looks assured with that group of people in your country. How do you assess the risks at the moment?
No, I don't think that the peace is at risk. I think that many people would like to put a stop to the implementation of the peace process. But we have, fortunately, a constitutional court that is defending the peace agreement, that has said that for the next three presidential periods, no government can approve any reform that goes against the implementation of the peace process. And the Constitutional Court is the highest court that we have, and we have to respect that, and I am quite confident that we will continue with the normal problems that any peace process has, especially one so comprehensive and so ambitious and difficult as the one in Colombia.
So violence has fallen overall, but it's still a very high death toll, isn't there? Social leaders, trade unionists, human rights activists, over 100 assassinated that we know about, according to UN figures, in the past year, former FARC targeted after leaving. Is this just a lot more fragile than you would have hoped at this point?
All peace processes have a backlash, and we are having a backlash after 54 years of war. And the people who thought that the day we signed, every single assassination and every single act of violence was going to end, well, they were too optimistic. We knew that there's a transition period where we have to be very effective in trying to bring the violence that always comes after a peace agreement like the one we signed.
But that sounds a bit like 1989 and the dawn of some hope then, that you could could come to an end with guerrilla conflicts. I'm trying to say that there were times in Colombian history when it maybe looked as if you were making a great leap forward.
No, there's no comparison.
You're shaking your head.
No comparison with the 1989. Colombia was on the verge of being declared a failed state. You had big drug cartels that were almost all-powerful and the state could not control them. And today's situation is very, very different from the one we lived through back in these terrible periods of the drug cartels and the paramilitaries. We now have peace with the FARC. We don't have paramilitaries. And the big drug cartels have been dismantled.
Despite those figures on the drug trade?
No, yes, but the drug trade will never disappear as long as people in London or in New York consume. This is a business that, unfortunately, is driven by the demand. And where there is demand, there will be supply, especially if prohibition increases the profits for the mafias that control the business. I just read the last biography of Winston Churchill, and I loved an anecdote that appears in this biography. When he went to the U.S. through Canada during Prohibition, and he asked for a drink, and of course they said, this is prohibited. And he said, this is a very strange country. These huge profits that are made with the liquor sales, here they allow these profits to go to the mafias. In my country, in the U.K., we give those profits to the Treasury. And I think he was quite right.
Your successor, President Duque, has refused to sign the bill which governs key hearings, the so-called Special Jurisdiction for Peace, the JEP, that you wanted to have established. It was, I suppose, in some ways akin to a kind of truth and reconciliation idea. Do you want to sort of tell us where you think that got to?
The agreement is signed, and we have to abide by the agreement. That's what agreements are signed for people to comply with them. Of course, many people say, well, there's an imperfection here, there's an imperfection there, but that was what was signed, what was agreed. And of course, if there are suggestions to improve the implementation of the agreements that are accepted by all parties, those suggestions will be most welcomed.
But it's more complicated than that, isn't it? Because we're seeing such legal challenges and a kind of constitutional challenge around what should happen there. I guess there is always a difficulty of a bridge from one era into another. No. So what is the right approach?
No, the right approach is to abide by what the courts say, in this case, the Constitutional Court. That's the instance where these differences are decided. And if the Constitutional Court says that you have to abide by the agreement, then you have to respect what the Constitutional Court says. And I think that's what democracy is all about.
Sure, but it seems that Mr. Duque wants the FARC to be subjected to rather harsher scrutiny and possibly harsher sentencing, and that he was fulfilling, as he sees it, a pledge to do that. Is that reasonable?
No, it's not reasonable, because that would be a change in the agreement. And the Constitutional Court says that there cannot be any changes in the agreement for the next three presidential periods. So nobody can suggest any changes in the agreement that are not agreed by all parties.
He says he doesn't want to terminate the agreement, he wants to improve it.
Well, if he wants to improve it, then sit with all the parties concerned and negotiate, but he cannot impose a change in the agreement, because that would be contrary to the spirit of the agreement.
And the underlying suggestion is, from your successor, is that the agreement is too friendly to the FARC. It lets them off too lightly.
That is his point of view. Other people think differently. Always when you make this type of agreements, you have to draw the line between peace and justice. And in every single agreement, you find people in either side that are not happy and that use politics for political reasons to criticize. It happened in Northern Ireland, it happened in South Africa, it happened in El Salvador, it happened everywhere. This is a part of the game of peacemaking.
Let's talk about other dissident groups in Colombia, particularly the National Liberation Army, the ELN. You opened peace talks with them, I think, around 2017, around that time, towards the end of your leadership. That's also particularly difficult and fraught at the moment because it complicates the relationship with Venezuela and the role of Venezuela providing a haven for the organization.
Well, yes, Venezuela provides a haven to this organization. We had advanced quite a bit with this group to sign a ceasefire. The new government decided not to continue this dialogue, and that's an autonomous decision of the new government. I don't agree with it, but they have all the right to do what they're doing. I hope that the decision that they took will not produce more violence in Colombia, but we will have to wait and see.
What has been the impact of the Venezuelan crisis, this particular point, on Colombia? About 1 million migrants produced by this terrible situation in Venezuela, your neighboring country.
Yes, I had to cope with that. And what I did was to open our hearts and our arms to the Venezuelans, because the Venezuelans had been very generous to Colombia when we were in trouble. And that's why we put in place a policy whereby we gave the Venezuelans special treatment, access to our education system, access to our health system, training for the Venezuelans to get jobs. We have roughly 1.3 million Venezuelans now living in Colombia. And this is a terrible problem for us, of course, but we have to try to cope with it and hopefully push for a rapid and peaceful transition in Venezuela.
Rapid and peaceful transition, rather elusive in Venezuela. Your successor, President Duque, has recognized Juan Guaido as the legitimate president. Do you share that view?
Well, what I share is that we need a golden bridge for the regime, because otherwise there will be violence. And violence is the worst of all outcomes, because there are many, many people who are armed in Venezuela. Violence will have a terrible impact on Colombia also, not only in Venezuela, and also for the rest of the region.
You've talked about a golden bridge. It's a memorable phrase. What do you mean by it?
I mean a dignified way out for the regime. If people expect the regime to simply give themselves up, this is not going to happen. They will prefer to die in battle than giving themselves up to end up in a jail like Noriega. This is reality. And therefore, you have to sit down and negotiate a transition. And to negotiate a transition, you have to include the major stakeholders. And the stakeholders that could produce this golden bridge are countries like China, like Russia, like Cuba, the U.S., and Latin America. Something has to be negotiated with the regime and with the opposition in order to allow for this transition to be rapid and peaceful. And we hopefully would have elections very fast if this transition is negotiated.
You sound like you're giving quite a large role in this to China and Russia, two global powers not often seen as the most effective peacemakers. Why are you so trusting about that?
Because they have expressed their interest in Venezuela. They have expressed their opposition in the Security Council to the resolutions about Venezuela that the U.S. has tabled. And they are players in this situation, because they have invested a lot of money and they have special relations with Venezuela. That's a fact. It's not simply a theory.
And what should happen? Where should the Golden Bridge lead? I mean, we're suggesting that Mr. Maduro ends up in China, in Russia, that he's out of the region? Or what would constitute the end of the bridge?
I have an example, which was the first time that the Ortega brothers in Nicaragua negotiated their way out of power. When the Ortega brothers negotiated their way out of power, they said, okay, I will leave power, and they would go live in some country, and their political party will maintain a certain degree of control of certain institutions or a percentage of Congress for them to feel that they're not going to be simply wiped out. Something of that sort.
What should happen to Mr. Maduro?
I'm not in the best position to suggest that. It's something that between Maduro and the opposition and the Venezuelans should decide.
And on American intervention, what would be useful and what would not be useful?
Well, the U.S. should maintain a prudent role there because a too active American intervention is counterproductive. That's why we created the Lima Group, in order to make this a Latin American initiative that would, in a way, try to suggest solutions and way out. It's better if it's a Latin American than if it's American or European. But of course, the Americans and Europeans are very much interested in also finding a peaceful and rapid solution. And of course, their support is most welcomed.
And does the character of Donald Trump play into this? Often an erratic leader, you're smiling. I mean, what impact does Donald Trump being president have on this crisis that maybe wouldn't be the case if it were another Republican or Democratic Party president?
Well, I had the opportunity to talk to President Trump a few times about this situation. I said that a military intervention was the worst way out, that nobody in Latin America would accept that. And I think what we have seen in the last weeks is proof of what I told him more than a year ago. And hopefully the U.S. could play a constructive role rather than a very proactive role.
Sounds like you want the U.S. to stay quite far in the background.
Well, the phantom of the U.S. intervention is still alive in Latin America, so the simple mention of this is a possibility puts many Latin Americans in a very worried situation.
We must talk about what you devote a lot of your time to now, and that is climate change, biodiversity, in particular, and I sense quite personal attachment, particularly to to the health of the marine environment. What are the priorities for you here, and particularly with your background of, I suppose, half a century of war and its consequences for physical landscape must be in your mind?
I do consider that climate change is probably the most important challenge the world has right now. We did a lot when I was in government to try to protect special biodiversity that Colombia has. Colombia is probably the richest country per square kilometer in the world in terms of biodiversity. And we have very, very rich areas in the marine environment that we also protected. When I arrived, there were about 12, 13 million hectares of protected areas. When I left the presidency, we added up to 43 million hectares that were protected from mining and agriculture. And I think that we have to do a lot more, not only in Colombia, of course, in the world, because no one country like in the drug trade can fight climate change by itself.
Finally, I must ask you, as we're here at an education conference here at in Dubai, education is not something where Colombia has really moved the dial in terms of its outcomes, since I think you're raising your eyebrow, so you might be about to challenge me. But I looked at the PISA data again this morning from the OECD, and you know, we still see Colombia, in many ways, such a connected, such an energetic country, still lagging behind there on what it is delivering across the core subjects. Any self-criticism on that, or what next? And what next?
I will tell you how we have progressed. In my government, for the first time in the Colombian history, for the last 5 years, education has been number one in our budget. And as you very well know, the priorities of any government are showed in the budget. And so we made education our first priority. We made education free access to public schools free for every children, every boy and girl in Colombia. In 3 or 4 years, you cannot correct a whole education system. But I think the progress that Colombia has made in the last years has been a tremendous progress. And this is what the OECD says. I'm not saying it. It's the OECD says Colombia has made tremendous progress. Of course, that we have a long way to go yet, because we come from way down from where we were. So we're making progress. We need to do a lot more progress.
Juan Manuel Santos, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me in your program.
And of course, we'd love to know what you think. How can Colombia balance the competing demands of peace, justice, and politics? Write to us, radio@economist.com, or tweet us at Economist Radio. And if you're not yet a subscriber, the first 12 issues are just $12 or £12 if you go to economist.com/radio offer. I'm Anne McElvoy, and in Dubai, this is The Economist.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.